We'd like to take this moment to thank our sponsor for this week's episode. The Well Bioscience is a developer of Vitrogel, a next-generation xeno-free 3D extracellular matrix that enables scientists to shift from 2D to 3D cell culture and help drive innovations for precision medicine, cell therapy, and biomanufacturing by getting faster and more accurate data than animal-based systems. Explore an array of high-throughput automation-capable hydrogels and bioinks that can open the door to 3D cell models for preclinical and clinical applications, and how Vitrogel can help researchers improve personalized medicine globally by visiting www.thewellbio.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Matter, the SLAS podcast where we interview life science luminaries. Today, we'll be continuing our series on new technologies. Joining us today is Roger Bosset, president of Biosignal 2, Inc., speaking with us today about using technologies based on lanthanide emission to perform ultra-sensitive assays. Welcome to the podcast, Roger.
Hello, Anna. Thank you.
Our pleasure. So to start off with, can you tell us a little bit about what are lanthanides and how can they be used for assays?
Sure. So lanthanides is coming from the Greek lanthanine. That word was first reported by a Swiss mineralogist called Victor Goldschmidt in 1925. So lanthanides are also called rare earths, but they're not so rare. A lot of, you know, people use them on a daily basis. Like, you know, everyone using a cell phone, you know, is using lanthanides indirectly because of the screen they use. You know, the red color is produced by lanthanide chelate, which is called European chelate. So there are about 15 of them. You know, they are metals. So when you do polish them, they become lustrous. They are also good heat and electricity conductors. So they are found in minerals such as bastnaesite, lauperite, xenotime, and monazite. So very big terms, very complex terms, but we will simplify, you know, that terminology by calling them ore. So to isolate the lanthanides, people are roasting the ore, followed by an acidic and basic leaching to basically concentrate them and isolate them. The most common one that we use in science are terbium, europium, samarium, and dysprosium. Based on their chemistry, their quantum yield, and also the lifetime of the fluorescence. One need to take into consideration that they need to be chelated with an antenna so we can excite them so we can produce a maximum fluorescence. Chelates also allows us to bioconjugate, you know, the lanthanides to various molecules. It's worth also noting that they require a special chelate composition to allow fluorescence in aqueous media.
So, you know, you said that you need to chelate them in order to maximize the fluorescence. What is it about these metals that makes them, are they inherently fluorescent and the chelating just enhances that? Or is there something about them that makes them more like prone to be this chelation process?
So basically to get, you know, a light emission, a fluorescence emission from the lanthanide, you have to excite them. Mm-hmm. So spontaneously, they won't be emitting light like, you know, other, you know, compounds can do. So basically you have to excite them. And when you do excite them through the antenna, which is part of the chelate, you're going to have a very bright fluorescence emission with very, very specific spectral properties that differs from traditional fluors such as fluorescein or cyanines. So you know that traditional fluors like fluorescein, they have overlapping spectra of excitation and emission. We say that they benefit of a small Stokes shift. So for correctly exploiting those fluors, we need to use narrow bandpass filters to prevent the contamination of the excitation source in the emission channel, which is in fact reducing the emission output. So for what regards lanthanides, they have very large Stokes shift. So their spectral properties allows us to excite them maximally without contaminating the emission channel. So basically we say that they have a large Stokes shift. So they are very bright spectrally and they do emit spectrally distinct fluorescence, which allows for multiplexing. For instance, one can excite terbium, and terbium will emit at 545 nanometers. Dysprosium will emit at 575 nanometers, europium at 615, and samarium at 645 nanometers. It's also good to take into consideration that depending on the chelate structure that you use, all those antenites can be excited at a single wavelength.
Wow, so that's pretty amazing that they're all excited at a single wavelength. What do you use for this antenna when you chelate the lanthanides?
So you have different molecules that you can work with. So you can work with various derivatives of phenantrolene, for instance, and other, you know, molecules where the name is very complicated. I will simply use, you know, the acronym like BTA. So BTA, DPA, and phenantrolene derivatives are, you know, used in conjugation to stabilize the lanthanide in close proximity to the antenna.
I see. And at what stage in the process does this chelation have to occur? Is this something that happens before researchers get the lanthanides?
Absolutely, absolutely. That is done, you know, by expert organic chemists. And also the purification of those lanthanide chelate is quite tedious. Yeah, one needs to do to leave, you know, that in the end, on the expert hands of organic chemists. So once the chelate is done, anybody can use that after.
Ah, I see. Well, that's really cool. So I wonder, you know, you've said a lot of really interesting things about lanthanides already, but I'm wondering for you personally, what first got you interested in the use of lanthanide probes?
It's definitely related to their, you know, spectral properties. So I was looking for molecules that could be excited using current lasers and that would also emit very specific light at specific wavelength. So what, you know, the lanthanides allows our labs to do is to create technologies that are very sensitive and also that can allow us to avoid prompt fluorescence that causes interference, you know, with most of the fluorescence-based assay. And also what, you know, helps in the circumstance of, you know, different assays that are run with specifically, you know, scarce samples, we can microformat the assays, which helps reducing the consumption of scarce samples. So this is, you know, what makes our life easier in our lab using lanthanides.
Okay. So what specific research problems does this technology solve? You know, we've talked about the fact that there is less overlap in the wavelength. So, you know, how specifically does this benefit the researchers?
I'd say once again, you know, when you want to produce very sensitive assays, when you want to also detect various phenomena or various biomarkers in the same assay, so you're thinking of doing multiplexing. So compared to traditional fluores, lanthanide allows for developing very sensitive assays. And also you can multiplex them so to get more information from those very precious samples that often we have to study.
Oh, I see. So it helps a lot with looking when you want to identify multiple biomarkers in one sample.
Exactly. So when you want to do ratiometric measurement, for instance, of total proteins versus a portion of that protein, which is modified, you know, in a transient manner, such as phosphorylation. So this is particularly useful to use lanthanides for doing, you know, that type of ratiometric measurement.
I see. Well, that's really interesting. And how then are these assays visualized? What sort of tools, what sort of microscopy do you need in order to visualize the results of an assay using lanthanide probes?
So you have basically three modes of detecting the emission of lanthanides. So you mentioned microscopy. So microscopy is a good tool to look for the emission, the fluorescence by lanthanides following their excitation. So that allows, for instance, to do in vivo bioimaging. The other, you know, a very cool mode of detecting fluorescence by microscopy is to use a new method called STED, so meaning stimulated emission depletion, where two laser sources are used. One is to excite the lanthanide. The other laser is to deactivate the lanthanide. So you measure the speed of the activation. Okay. So the second mode for detecting the emission of lanthanides is to rely on a photomultiplier tube, which is converting light into an analog or digital, you know, output. So this is what we use normally with multi-label reader equipped with a laser, once again, to excite the lanthanide, or you can also use collimated xenon flash lamp, and you use that photomultiplier to read the final emission, you know, fluorescence emission by the lanthanide. Or you can simply use your eye. So just think about, you know, the monitor and TV screens that do rely on lanthanides for emitting colors. So those lanthanides are often included into organic LEDs, composing, once again, the screens of smartphones, monitor, and TV screens.
So you'd mentioned that you could measure the speed of the activation by having the laser that activates and then the laser that deactivates. What does the speed of activation tell the researcher when they're looking at their samples?
That's giving them basically the two indications when you're performing SED microscopy, the location, the concentration.
I see. And so what types of research are these sort of lanthanide-based assays ideal for? It sounds like, you know, you wouldn't necessarily maybe use them for identifying, you know, cellular components, but maybe more looking at the quantities of biomarkers.
All right. So yeah, regarding, you know, there's wide applicability, you know, of lanthanide-based assays. And essentially they're used mostly, once again, to detect biomarkers. So you can think of using them to replace traditional technologies such as immunoassays like ELISA. And, you know, these assays are found in different labs, whether they are academic or industrial. Whether, you know, those labs are involved into preclinical, clinical, diagnostic, including point of care, and forensics activities. Once again, they're very, very, very good, you know, to substitute former technologies when it's time to perform immunoassays, such as doing biomarker detection or studying protein-protein interactions. The most, I would say, common lanthanide-based assays are TRF, standing for time result fluorescence assays, where you do the substitution of chromogenic reporters such as HRP by a lanthanide chelate. So when people want to explore the qualities of lanthanide-based assays and they're used to work with ELISA, the easiest way to convert a traditional ELISA into a lanthanide-based one is to work with TRF. A second technique is called TRFRET. Now, TRFRET stands for time result fluorescence energy transfer. Now it's an homogeneous assay, contrasting with TRF, that is a wash-based assay, where you have to involve wash steps to finally read the emission of the lanthanide. TRFRET is homogeneous. So it's a mix and measure type of assay based on proximity of a donor molecule and an acceptor molecule. So you can think of this typical sandwich ELISA, where first antibody is labeled with an lanthanide chelate, such as European chelate, which is used as an energy transfer donor after its excitation between 320 to 340 nanometers. And the second antibody in that sandwich configuration is labeled with a redshifted dye, such as a cyanin dye, acting as an energy transfer acceptor at 615 nanometer. And then, you know, that cyanin dye will finally emit light at 665 nanometers for the final emission. So one needs to know that the distance required for proximity is 10 nanometer and less. And one critical factor depends on the dipole alignment. So when you want to do energy transfer between a lanthanide chelate and a cyanin acceptor dye, the dipoles of those molecules should be in perfect alignment for optimum energy transfer. There's a third application or technique called loci, in our labs we call it Omega. So that's the one we've been exploiting in our lab. So it's based on using very small particles, about 200 nanometers in size. So low size stands for luminescent oxygen channeling. So now the energy transfer is not done through light energy transfer, but through a chemical energy transfer. So once again, we're going to be using that example with the sandwich ELISA configuration. In that case, the antibodies that we can use are coated in one of the beads, which are called Sensi beads. So these beads do contain inside a chemical that helps producing singlet oxygen after excitation at 600 nanometers. So you have that Sensi bead containing that element converting ambient oxygen into singlet oxygen. And singlet oxygen is molecular oxygen in an excited state that is capable to react with very specific chemical traps. And those chemical traps are embedded in the second bead, which is called a Kenny bead. So that singlet oxygen will react with that singlet oxygen trap will react with singlet oxygen to produce light that is used to excite a lanthanide chelate now embedded into that Kimi bead. So when you bring the two beads into proximity through the presence of an antigen that is detected simultaneously by the two antibodies that are pre-conjugated onto the beads, now you have a proximity allowing for the oxygen, singlet oxygen to be transferred from one bead to the other, where you know the final reaction will emit light. So contrasting to TR-FRET, the distance for proximity is 200 nanometers because of the lifetime of singlet oxygen in solution. And there's no dipole orientation consideration. So since the energy transfer is done through a chemical release in three dimensions, one also can know that we're reading below the wavelength of excitation. So 615 nanometers emitted by the Kimi beads is below that wavelength of excitation that we use for the Sensi beads, which is 600 nanometer. The net benefit of that is that there's no occurrence of prompt fluorescence resulting in very low background assays.
So how difficult is it to perform an assay using these lanthanide probes as compared to all of these other methods that you were just discussing? Is there a really steep learning curve, or is it, if you're familiar with the traditional ELISA, it's pretty easy to pick this one up?
I think it's very easy to pick, every of these technology up rapidly. So the learning curve is very short. So I was able to train trainees in less than a week to be very fluent with all those three methods. No. So once you are good at running a traditional immunoassay using a technique, gold standard technique like ELISA, it doesn't take much time to fully exploit, the performance of a lanthanide-based assay.
That's great. Is there any differences in the sample prep for these lanthanide-based assays as compared to some of the, these other assays?
That's a pretty good question. As I mentioned to you, like TR-FRET, which is based on a very simple substitution of chromophore by lanthanide chelate, since it's still a wash assay, there's some minimum preparation that needs to be done. So basically, one can think of the major contaminant of a biological sample being hemoglobin. So you don't need to do a pre-treatment of your biological sample. So you can, wash the interfering molecule, which is hemoglobin in that case, by performing the wash steps. For the other two techniques, TR-FRET and LOCI, since they are mix and measure assays that do not involve any wash steps, you have to be very careful about your sample. You want to limit the concentration of interfering molecules such as hemoglobin to a minimum. Because in the case of TR-FRET, hemoglobin, since it quenches light from 300 to 600 nanometers, there's a risk to decrease your energy transfer process if hemoglobin is present in a high concentration. Same for loci. So in that case, there's no quenching basically of hemoglobin from a color standpoint, from a spectral standpoint, but it's going to react with singlet oxygen. Since singlet oxygen is molecular oxygen and the nature of hemoglobin is to fix oxygen, so you're going to get, singlet oxygen quenching, which will also result in a decrease of the energy transfer process.
So it sounds like hemoglobin is really the enemy of this type of assay.
That's the enemy for any technology, basically. Yeah.
Are there any major, you know, aside from this hemoglobin issue, are there any major disadvantages to using this technique?
No, color quenching and singlet oxygen quenching are the major drawbacks here, but they can easily be avoided if you take the necessary precautions to eliminate what we're defining as the enemy in the assay. So let's get rid of hemoglobin, and there's no really, you know, matter regarding the other, you know, the other aspects of using lanthanides.
In your mind, are there any particular applications for this technology that aren't currently being utilized?
Oh, that's a pretty good question. So lanthanide-based assays have limited applicability to study directly the intracellular mechanism occurring in live cells. There are a few assays that do rely on lanthanides, but they are scarce. So one can think of, for instance, using tiarfret as a breath substitute, but this is not yet the case. So that's an area of research that would be interesting to explore. Microfluidics application are being developed at the moment, but once again, they are not vastly exploited. So one can think, for instance, of embedding wafers with lanthanide in specific areas of the microchip and at different ratios to emit light, different composition of light to allow for multiplexing. But once again, the microfluidics application of lanthanide-based technologies are not very well exploited at the moment.
Yeah, so maybe as microfluidics become more popular and more common, then the lanthanide probes will be more well utilized in that space, you think?
Yeah, absolutely. This is what I see, you know, happening in the future. Yeah.
So if there was a researcher out there listening who's interested in starting to use lanthanide-based assays for their research, you know, what are some of the major things that they would need to know to get started?
Yeah, the first thing to take into consideration is the nature of the sample that one wants to characterize, especially regarding its potential contamination by hemoglobin. So if you have a contaminant that cannot be removed or reduced, you have to opt, for instance, to a traditional type of wash-based assay. So, for instance, if you have a sample, a serum sample, a blood sample, where you cannot remove hemoglobin based on a very low concentration of analyte to detect, you would be better to opt for a tiarfret-based assay. Now you have to think about the nature of the assay, whether it's homogeneous or heterogeneous. So if you want to perform, for instance, a tiarfret assay versus a TRF assay, if you run the latter, you're at risk of losing analyte, the analyte of interest during wash tips, which will lead to reduced sensitivity of your assay. So in that case, it's better to opt for an homogeneous assay such as tiarfret or loci, if you don't want to lose precious analytes to increase your assay sensitivity. Now, when it's time to consider using tiarfret versus loci, you have to take in consideration the complexity of the interaction you want to study or the size of the analyte you want to detect. Once again, what makes tiarfret different from loci? There's a distance for proximity that plays a critical role and dipole orientation for tiarfret. So loci is exceptionally good at detecting low affinity interaction prevailing between very large and complex biomolecular structures based on the way that the technology is structured. Since you deal with chemical energy transfer leading to large distance for proximity, if one, once again, would need to detect low affinity interaction prevailing between very large and complex biomolecule structure, one need to think of using loci instead of tiarfret.
Are there any future advances that you're hoping to make with this technology?
Externally, in collaboration, I would like to see how fluorescence lifetime could be used advantageously with lanthanides, and also how one can, you know, study with very high spatial resolution. We're talking about 50 to 70 nanometer here, which is impossible with traditional microscopy. One could use lanthanides and use them with STED microscopy. In my group, we have in mind, we have projected to use microfluidics to detect our loci version, which is called Omega. And we would like also to start thinking of developing assays for performing the analysis of intracellular processes occurring in live cells. Once again, you know, as a substitute for BRET, which is standing for bioresonant energy transfer, so which is very popular at the moment to study those intracellular processes happening live in cell assays.
Well, we are getting close to the end of our time here, but I just wanted to know, is there anything else that you really want people to know about these lanthanide probes that we didn't get a chance to discuss yet today?
Yeah, so you can think of their name as rare earths, but they're not so rare, so we can fully take advantage of using them in any type of assay you have in mind performing as a substitute to traditional techniques.
Fantastic. Well, Roger, thank you so much for joining us here today. It's been an absolute pleasure having you. And I'm sure that anybody who's interested in learning more or pursuing using these lanthanide probes in their research can go to the BioSignal 2 Inc. website and just learn more about all of the probes that you guys provide.
My pleasure, Anna. And once again, as you mentioned, people can look at our website. They are going to find, you know, more information about, you know, the technologies that I discussed with you today. And hopefully we can see each other at the next SLAS meeting that will occur in San Diego next year.
Absolutely. We can't wait to see you there.
Thank you, Anna.